But it was the turnovers, really, I think, when we had a chance to take the lead. And then specifically, obviously, the timely offensive rebounds that we gave up, which they have been doing. You know, that's their knack. That's how they've survived and gotten to this point. They get the right ones at the right time.
You guys are doing a really good job that first half, getting points in the paint. Got a little bit away from that. Michigan State, they ended up, for the game, it ended up 32-32. Michigan State had 26 in that second half. And I think a little bit was that ball screen coverage, offensive rebounds.
Offensive rebounds, ball screen coverage, you know, the transition that ends up being, you know, we had two or three pick sixes. We turned the ball over that led to transition baskets for them. But, yeah, it wasn't the back you down. It was the two guys running with the ball and not having a guy loading back at the rim, being too spread out behind it, in terms of the points in the paint. We had the ball inside. We missed some looks. We missed some layups, missed some point-blank ones. But like I said, when I break the film down here, it's going to be untimely turnovers and obviously, not cleaning up possessions, not finish the possession with the rebound where we had got them into a tough look and we gave them another 20 seconds to get a better look.
Talking about rebounds, Nolan Winter with 17 of them. You know, continue his growth, showing what he's done development-wise. When you look at Nolan, what was it that, you know, to continue to improve in that area, which he has so far, you know, this entire year?
Yeah, I think it's experience and strength. You know, he's stronger than he was a year ago, and he'll be stronger next year than what he is now. And I think that's just the evolution of a post player that you want to see happen. And he has a nose for the ball. He's got some toughness to him, and he's got some grit, and he's a battler. He just needs to continue to develop his body and develop his game. And obviously we got him to miss a fair amount when they shoot 48%, 39 for the game. You know, yeah. you give yourself a chance. I mean, I don't know if Blackwell and Tanji are going to go 2 for 15 a lot of days, but even given that fact, if we do a couple of those other little things better, that we're right where we need to be.
Yeah, it's a 2-point game with 4 minutes to play. You guys are in that thing as you guys shoot 5 right. for 32.
Right.
So you did everything you need to do with the last couple possessions. But, you know, two left here in Big Ten play. Obviously had a chance to talk to the guys. What's the message with two left as you got a lot to play for still?
Absolutely. I mean, we got to get back here today, rest, and get ready tomorrow for a Minnesota team that's coming in, you know, playing pretty well right now. If they won at the buzzer at Nebraska yesterday, obviously we know it's a rivalry border game. We got a lot to play for in terms of seeding in Big Ten play, NCAA tournament and beyond. But, this we'll learn from this. Maybe we'll see them down the road in Indianapolis or later in March.
All right. Thanks, Coach. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Brian.
All right, guys. Thank you very much. Michigan State a winner here this afternoon, 71-62. Back to close things out here in East Lansing in 1 minute. This is Badger Basketball from Learfield.
Reedsburg Area Medical Center has achieved the prestigious 5-star rating from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. This rating is the highest possible and places RAMC among the elite. Only 8% of hospitals nationwide received this distinction. The 5-star rating is based on 46 quality measures, including safety of care, patient experience, timely and effective care, and more. 5 stars indicates exceptional and consistent quality care right here in Reedsburg. RAMCHealth.com.
Many people have a special dream of building a home perfect for them and their family. Dreams are a wonderful thing, and when you're ready to make that dream come true, look to the Richland County Bank. The experienced lenders at Richland County Bank can help you turn your blueprints into a construction plan and building schedule. The team will create a customized loan for the construction of your primary or even a second home. Put your dreams in motion with the help of Richland County Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. Governor Tony Evers has released his budget, calling this the most pro-kid budget in state history. This is now the fourth time that Evers has put forth a budget proposal, and the three prior were all met with a similar fate. Republicans in the legislature rejected it entirely. Again this year, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss called the budget dead on arrival. To a certain extent, this is what we've come to expect from this era of divided government in Wisconsin. In previous years, Evers has eventually signed Republican-authored budgets and used his line-item veto powers to make certain changes. But could he play hardball this time around and threaten to veto the entire budget? Is there anything in this pro-kid budget that has to be there? Things like education funding, or clean water protections, or Medicaid expansion? With everything going on in Washington, now might be the right time for Evers to fight for these proposals and fight for Wisconsinites in any way he can.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us.
You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
Join us on Wednesday night as the Badgers take on the Minnesota Golden Gophers. Thanks for listening. This is the Badger Sports Network from Learfield.
Badger basketball has been brought to you by Alliant Energy. Alliant Energy is powering beyond for you. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Ho-Chunk Gaming Madison and Ho-Chunk Gaming Wisconsin Dells. Proud casino partners of Wisconsin Athletics. And by Fabic Rents. For all your equipment rental needs throughout Badgerland. The preceding has been a Learfield presentation of the Badger Sports Network.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Milwaukee film critic Matt Miller and from the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point, chair of the musical theater department, Mark Hansen. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8. News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel, your host for this, the second hour of our weekend broadcast, providing some insights, some perspective, yes, some reporting on what happens in America and beyond, but also some assessment of what it means, and spending a lot of time necessarily in this weekend broadcast, assessing the implications for justice, for the rule of law, for the administration of international relationships, when it comes to what happened yesterday, Friday, in Washington, D.C., this incredible rebuke of the Ukrainian president by our vice president and our president. Interestingly, a couple of follow-ups to that all-important event that changes the world order, just as Donald Trump changed the domestic order 10 days earlier. A couple of updates to all of that, and one is that notwithstanding the things that our president has said about Zelensky, Zelensky continues to be the consummate diplomat. He says, among other things, that the relationship with the United States and with Donald Trump in particular is salvageable, and that he implicitly looks forward to a continuation of it, that we remain a strategic partner with him and his nation. That's the kind of thing that you say because you believe it and you mean it and you want to promote the good relationship that has existed by virtue of using those kinds of words, unlike the words used by our president on Friday. By using those kinds of affirming things, you not only affirm the relationship, but you also establish yourself as the better person, do you not? That even though you've had this fight that now appears in the annals of history, world history, you are willing and you are able and you are prepared to go forward to try to repair what damage has been done and to continue with the partnership that has produced not a complete result, not a clear result there in Ukraine, but continues to push back on the very things that are anathema to our nation. Second, even while that is going on, the reaffirmation of our ally, of the Ukrainian president, to a continued partnership. What is he doing? Where did he go? He went overseas. He crossed that ocean that he talked about in providing some perspective to our president. He crossed the ocean. He appeared in London. And yes, indeed, he is meeting. He is now meeting with the prime minister, the newly elected prime minister, Keir Starmer, who appeared, yes, in that same chair in the Oval Office earlier in the week, plainly to talk about not only what happened across the ocean in Washington, D.C., but also perhaps to reaffirm inside this new world order the relationship between Ukraine and Great Britain. Interesting to see what Zelensky may do with others in Western Europe, including Emmanuel Macron, including the head of the EU, all of whom may now, in the wake of our president's apparent decision to vacate the position as leader of the free world, maybe one of them is going to become that person. And Volodymyr Zelensky undeniably working on all of that, not only to continue to support the ties with the United States, but uncertain about where this is going, also engaging for the legitimacy of his nation, the security of the entire world in reaffirming good relationships with Great Britain, with France, and with others. All of that happening in the wake of what happened on Friday of just this past week. Here on Amicus Solar Review, we try to emphasize the rule of law takeaways. There are a lot of them from this event. There are an awful lot of rule of law continuing takeaways from the other things that this president has done just in recent days and weeks that have huge implications. And this event, this circumstance about which we will now talk, is the perfect segue, if you will, between the international aspect of what happened in the Oval Office on Friday and what happened about a week ago, also connected with our domestic tranquility, our security, our safety, and also our position on the face of the planet. You may recall well that briefly, and not with nearly enough clarity and nearly enough exposition last week, we touched on the fact that among the other things that my president did last week is to fire General Charles Q. Brown, Jr., who up until that time had been an exemplary chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, responsible for supervising, again, in a military context, the operations of our armed forces inside the Department of Defense. He also fired Lisa Franchetti. She's the chief of naval operations. General James Slife, he's the vice chief of staff of the Air Force. And most ominously, as we also talked about, one of our callers also highlighted the significance of this too, focusing upon, yes, international issues, yes, domestic issues, but yes, also the role that lawyers inside the military play. Donald Trump also fired the officers who serve as the top lawyers of the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy there at the Department of Defense. None of those individuals, the judge advocates general, none of those individuals being unsubordinate, none of them were leading some failing war, justifying their termination. General Brown's chief sin appeared to have been endorsing the military's, yes, that's right, their diversity efforts to ensure that our military forces look like America. The president apparently did not like that. For example, after George Floyd's horrific murder, which we've talked a lot about on this broadcast, General Brown appropriately, wisely, thoughtfully, caringly recorded a 4-minute video. And that thing reflected on his experiences as a black Air Force officer and put in context the importance of diversity inside our military. Pete Hegseth, who, as you know, is our current Secretary of Defense, had previously questioned whether Brown had been promoted to the chairman position because he was black. Shocking thing for our present Secretary of Defense to have said in the past. Hegseth, for what it's worth, long expressed disdain for the role of military lawyers in his 2024 book, a thing called The War on Warriors. That's written by our current Secretary of Defense. He derisively referred to the lawyers, again, a word that unfortunately came up during the course of his confirmation hearing. It is embarrassing to talk about it, but this is the language from our Secretary of Defense. He referred to the lawyers inside the Department of Defense, the judge advocates general. We call them the JAG officers. He referred to them as JAGOFs, and he blamed them for their restrictive rules of engagement. He blamed them for the counsel that they provide and for the review of everything from war crimes prosecutions of American service members to advice given in the field. Significant that General Charles Q. Brown, the former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, replaced by General Dan Razin, R-A-Z-I-N, that's in parentheses or in quotes, because that's his nickname, General Dan Kane, Dan Razin Kane. He's a retired 3-star Air Force general, never held any major combat positions, like the Central Command, which controls American forces in the Middle East, as you probably know. He now is in the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff there. Donald Trump long expressing great admiration for General Kane, saying that Kane told him in his first term that the fight against ISIS, remember this, could be finished in 1 week. That's attractive to Donald Trump. And he remembers that. Donald Trump also claimed that Kane had said that he loved Donald Trump. He would kill for Donald Trump. And that he put on a MAGA hat in front of Donald Trump. All inappropriate things for a military officer, decidedly supposed to be apolitical, nonpartisan to do. Nonetheless, he now is the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Department of Defense. Now, what about these JAG officers? Why are they so important? I've hinted at it already. Why am I revisiting this as a rule of law matter, which we should all be concerned about? And again, depending upon your assessment of the significance of this, respond inappropriately and respond with derision and with opposition, in opposition to what the president has done. Why? Because it is a fundamental premise of the lawyers inside the Department of Defense to provide that all-important counsel to the military chiefs there. It is very important that all of us understand what the role of JAG officers in the military is. They serve as advisors to the commanders. That's right, advisors. They cannot tell them what to do. But if commanders have concerns and issues about great numbers of things, everything from personnel issues to the ways in which battles are conducted in the field, it is the lawyers who know the rules of law, the rules of deployment. They understand how treatments of prisoners are to be conducted. They understand all of this. They don't command troops in combat, but they provide all important advice that ensures that when we engage in the very worst thing that Americans can engage in, that anybody on the face of the planet can engage in, and that is war, that it is done consistent with, yes, indeed, there are rules of war, and that we do that based upon our Constitution. We do that based upon common historical understandings to ensure that even as we do this horrific thing called war, we are doing it in compliance with what the United States has been all about. Legal standards, those things that are adopted and enforced by the Secretary of Defense, but really practically enforced by these JAG officers, are hugely relevant to combat operations. And so, as I just said, they can dictate the very tactics that soldiers use on the battlefield as commanders ask, is it now appropriate under these circumstances to engage in this activity? And yes, it is very difficult in the midst of a war, a battle, to call and ask the lawyers what to do. I get that completely, as do the officers themselves. But when it comes to planning, as does the Defense Department on a routine basis, it is important that the lawyers be in the room to ensure that whatever is done defensively and offensively is once again consistent with combat operations first and foremost, and those combat operations have inside them understandings about how those operations are to be conducted. Weapons commanders deploy, also a part of the focus of JAG officers, the treatment of prisoners as well. How do I know all of this? I know all of this because I worked with JAG officers when I was in Iraq. I was not a military attorney myself, but depended upon them hugely to ensure the legitimacy of our operation there in Iraq. When we come back, we're going to talk more about why that issue is so important and also take your calls, your questions, as Amicus, a law review, continues.
This is News from the Center, WRCE.
Every year, millions of pets go missing, leaving families heartbroken. If you lose or find a pet, LoveLost is here to help. Our free, easy-to-use platform uses photo matching technology across multiple media platforms to bring lost pets home. Just upload a photo and quickly search the largest national lost and found pet database. Let's unite to reunite. Because every lost pet deserves to find their way home. Register today at lovelost.com.
Earl Ingram.
Dr. Omar, we sometimes think I'm going to lose weight. I'm at the gym 3-4 times a week, and then 2 months down the road, they see that they've lost 3 pounds.
Think of the four main things to help us balance: how I sleep, how I eat, how I live, and my relationships. Don't shy away from seeking therapy. We need to seek that support to keep our health goals going.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Solarview. My name is Jim Santel. Talking about the rule of law in connection with this decision about a week or so ago of our president to fire not only this well-respected and superb chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, his name is Charles Brown, replacing him by Dan Raisin Kane, who is now occupying and encumbering that position, also firing the chief of naval operations, the vice chief of staff of the Air Force, and again, the position here, the view here coming from me is that most ominously, firing also the lawyers, the officers who serve as the top lawyers for the Army, the Air Force, the Navy, those are the JAG officers there, and explaining why that issue, those firings are no less significant than the firings of the top military leaders there, focusing upon what it is those JAG officers do to ensure that our combat operations, the way we treat prisoners, the way that we engage in war, as stunning as that is even to say out loud, is consistent with fundamental understandings about humanity, the rules of war. Dismissing JAG officers does not change the rules, but it can, in fact, from my perspective and the perspective of anyone else who knows even a little bit about this, degrade the quality of the legal advice that the commanders receive. And that affects not only the operations of war and battle on the battlefield, but also our position, the integrity of what we're doing in the international sphere. If military lawyers are afraid to or somehow chilled from providing good faith advice for fear that it might anger the president, the immediate supervisors, the political leadership there, that enhances the chances that America's forces will create, will make some catastrophic mistake, and that could, in fact, affect dramatically the course of war, the course of how we are perceived in the international arena, and yes, indeed, our very safety and security. The firing of these top JAG officers, again, spoke directly to me because of my great admiration for them during the 2 years that I was in Iraq. I was not among their ranks. I was a civilian from the Department of Justice. They're working on rule of law issues with judges and prisoners and corrections and police. But they worked also to provide, along with our rule of law office there, an awful lot of advice to General Petraeus and others who were responsible, giving them that sage advice that lawyers can and should provide, tremendously important to the operation of that effort. And yes, indeed, as I always say, I appreciate that the war effort there remains controversial. But inside that operation, I, to this day, view the operation of those JAG officers, those lawyers then and to this day, as hugely important to ensure that whatever we did, not with perfection, was done well and was done with an understanding that there are rules that do, in fact, apply. That is a significant lesson coming out of what our president has once again done to reorder the military in connection with his continuing work, his attempt to restyle the very ways in which our government operates, including at the Department of Defense. A little later on, we'll talk about the latest at the Department of Justice. As always, appreciate callers. And in fact, this caller most appropriately because, Joe, it was you who last week called in and highlighted this very notion that the president had also fired the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and also these JAG officers. So appreciate tremendously, Joe, your contributions, your presence here again on Amicus Law Review.
Yeah, Jim, the world is hurtling in some interesting directions. I thank you so much for your show, and the background and the specificity of all is just fantastic. Thank your producer, but also thank your callers, you know, the regulars such as Mark or L.A. Tom, whomever. But I want to particularly thank a caller from the last hour. His name was Rick, and
yes,
he was talking about land itself, and it was,
yep,
a very interesting point he had to make. He was talking about farmland, and of course, Ukraine has been the breadbasket of Russia for decades and decades, and boy, they want it back. And when you were speaking of changes in stylings in the world order, I would say that Putin is looking for a restyling of what he had before under the Soviet Union. If you look at land, there are lots of things that it can provide: farmland, minerals, oil, water aquifers. But if you look at this, you look at a map, and that's so valuable to just look at a map. Location is a huge thing,
yes,
that is it within the desire to have Ukraine back because of the access to the Black Sea, and they want a warm water port. But it's more than that. It is the prestige. Putin has said, former KGB guy, that he wants to return to the borders of the Soviet Union. Get out a map and look at that. Holy cow, we're talking about those countries that would be either part of the USSR again, or Russia, or what was described previously, the Iron Curtain. Remember,
right,
the Iron Curtain?
Absolutely.
Okay, so we're talking about Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Belarus, Poland, East Germany, Czech Republic. I mean, come on, it's huge. It is extremely sobering to look at that map and realize this is what he would like to return to. He has said this in the past, what this means for Europe, what it means for us, and what it means for us if our president is now allying himself with Russia and not the EU and not our allies that we've had for 80 years, but instead a country which would like to return to the land grab it had previously. So I would urge people, look at a map, just,
yes,
type in Iron Curtain, and it's sobering. It's very sobering. Thanks, Jim, as always.
Joe, sobering indeed. Tremendous comments, tremendous. We like to do instruction and maybe from time to time homework assignments. I appreciate that homework assignment. Let me reinforce that notion again. It is worth it if you have not consumed the 7 minutes of history that happened yesterday in the Oval Office, as Joe and other callers have responded to. Also, let's take up Joe's good instruction, her good direction, encouragement to us to pull out the map and take a look at where Crimea is. Take a look at where those Eastern Bloc nations are. It is a huge amount of land, and it is also, Joe, as you implicitly said, it's also bordering on our allies right there, and that's the concern. When Volodymyr Zelensky says to our president yesterday, you know, there's an ocean, you've got that ocean, but the reality is, especially in 2025, in this early portion of the 21st century, that doesn't save you anymore. And your point, Joe, about the possibility that Putin, again, looking at a map, as he certainly does all the time, having taken Crimea in 2014, now going into and not completely securing, but plainly seizing huge amounts of land already inside Ukraine, looking to those other nations, that's the concern, in addition to ensuring the sovereignty of Ukraine. But what happens next? What happens next? And as Joe, you said so articulately, that significance of the future. This is not just about what happens overseas in a place that's not so distant from us in the end, but once again, important to take a look at the map and see where we are in this new world order. Joe, appreciate very much the comments. Also the comments, again, highlighting what Rick has said as well. I'm going to talk more about all of that. I'm going to comment as well and provide some perspective. A couple of comments coming in from Dick in Cottage Grove saying that Trump's assertion that Ukraine started the war is simply untrue. He says we can no longer suffer people being nice to this international criminal. Got another comment coming in on our text line. GOP representatives will continue to cower unless they hear from their base that they're unhappy. We can't be happy about Russia being embraced. Very good comments. We'll talk about that and more, including the Department of Justice, when Amicus Law Review continues.
News from the Center, WRCE.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. After that White House diplomatic meeting between President Trump and Ukraine's President Zelensky went terribly wrong.
The breach of trust here is profound, and it's going to have consequences not just for the rest of this administration, but really for decades to come.
Former State Department official Elliot Cohn of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Ukraine's President Zelensky getting a much warmer welcome by European allies in London today. They say they'll hammer out a plan to stop the fighting and then discuss it with the U.S. New York's former Governor Andrew Cuomo, who resigned amid multiple sexual allegations of harassment, now plotting a return to politics, announcing a run for New York City mayor. Israel says it's stopping the entry of all goods and supplies into Gaza, Hamas calling Israel's move, quote, cheap blackmail and a war crime. Israel says that the militant group needs to accept a new proposal to extend the already fragile ceasefire. This is ABC News.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
More Badgers in the NFL. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports in Indianapolis, where the NFL Scouting Combine is wrapping up today. Over 300 athletes, including Wisconsin offensive tackle Jack Nelson, getting ready for the NFL draft. Nelson from Stoughton, Wisconsin. His father, Todd, played tackle for the Badgers in the late 80s. His younger brother, Barrett, still on the team. I asked him how much this moment means to him, interviewing with teams from the NFL.
You know, it's a great feeling, you know, kind of put that on your back and be the one to put on for your city, for your family like that.
College basketball, Marquette beat Georgetown 76-61. UWM over Detroit Mercy 89-67. The Bucks beat the Mavericks 132-117, but Milwaukee's Kyle Kuzma suffering an ankle injury.
Yeah, he twisted his ankle. Kept going. We were happy we didn't have to bring him back in, though.
Is that something you just got to evaluate?
Yeah, I have no idea. They don't think it's a bad one, but you don't really know until the next day. So
that's Bucks head coach Doc Rivers with Sports on Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Quite a bit of sunshine today. Just a few high clouds thrown in for good measure as well. Otherwise, light south to southwest winds and highs in the lower 40s. Tonight, partly cloudy skies, lows in the mid-20s. A little rain possible Monday afternoon, near 50. Currently 35 degrees.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. If you're headed to vote in New Hampshire's traditional March town meetings and need to register, bring proof of citizenship documents with you or you won't be able to vote. 20 other states have similar legislation pending. New Hampshire's HB 1569 eliminated sworn citizenship affidavits, subject to fines or imprisonment for lying, as evidence of citizenship. It now accepts only a birth certificate, U.S. passport, or naturalization papers. There is no evidence of any widespread non-citizen voting in the state, and the law was immediately challenged in federal district court as unconstitutional and an unreasonable burden. President Donald Trump's recent unfounded claims of widespread non-citizen voting generated a rush to tighten proof of citizenship legislation around the country. Voting Rights Lab is tracking 35 proof of citizenship bills in 20 states, many based on model legislation pushed by former Trump election lawyer Cleta Mitchell and her Only Citizens Vote coalition. Just this month, proof of citizenship bills were advanced in Wyoming and Missouri. 18 other states are considering bills adding proof of citizenship requirements, and the pending SAVE Act in Congress would require it for federal elections. A 2024 study by the Brennan Center for Justice found 9% of Americans don't have ready access to their citizenship documents. We have links to the Voting Rights Lab tracker and more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
The Dom Salvia Show.
Elon Musk. You're going to fire a bunch of folks. Well, that's going to, you know, increase unemployment. That's going to have an impact on the economy. The government buys farmers' goods for the USAID and no more USAID. Well, this thing's going to rot in the field. What happens to the prices? What happens to the farmers? What is the point here? It just seems like these are just such amateur decision-making, wasting our taxpayer dollars by wasting people's time.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app. Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time. We'll take a look back at the Badger basketball game over the weekend and also find out whether we still have a country. If we do, join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show. Weekdays noon till 2.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel here, coming from the broadcast station of Civic Media and Radio Park Racine, joined in the broadcast studio by my excellent producer. His name is Max, and as always, taking your phone calls, your comments, your questions at 855-752-4842. And that includes Ali calling into our broadcast this weekend. Ali, appreciate your contributions to our discussion.
Well, I have several things. One is that Jack also oversees treaties. You know, in their law experience, they also do like what's right and what's wrong during military engagement.
Absolutely.
And therefore, need to know about treaties.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that Putin has said quite a while back was he wanted Alaska back. And Alaska is not a huge ocean away. It's
right.
Just, I believe, the Bering Sea. So if he is allowed to take all of Ukraine's land back because they owned it at one time, Trump would be okaying this, in essence. Also, I think that we all really need to go back to basics, the who, what, when, where, how, and why of Trump's actions. I believe that he tried to control the military as far as during the protests, wanting the military to shoot protesters in the legs. That's why he's getting rid of Jag, is that they're not going to allow that. And I think that he is hoping for martial, that he can put a martial law into the country.
You get rid of the people, the lawyers in this case, who know what they're talking about, who are there to provide this service, right? As you said, Ali, not only with respect to treaties, but also the basic operations. You get rid of them, and therefore you see that there may be an easier path through these things that are plainly unconstitutional. We know well, and this is one of the references I think you're making, is to the former Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, who was his defense secretary in the first term. He infuriated Trump. Remember this in 2020 by publicly imposing the invocation of the Insurrection Act, which is that legislation plainly which permits the president to deploy troops, right, to impose order in American cities. That's our version of martial law. Esper said, no, I don't want you to do that, to the point that you're making right now. And he was also the one, Esper, who resisted Donald Trump's demand that law enforcement, yes, indeed, shoot protesters, Ali, as you have said, who were demonstrating outside the White House. Didn't like what Mark Esper, who was the Secretary of Defense, was telling him about the restrictions on his capacity to work. James Mattis also resigned as Secretary of Defense, we recall, under Donald Trump, after Donald Trump had abandoned some of our allies. They were Kurdish in northern Syria, northern Iraq, ordered a precipitous withdrawal of American troops. All those kinds of things result in Donald Trump dismissing secretaries of defense and others. And all of that animation, as you have just said, Ali, important to put all of that in perspective when we understand about what happened just this past week as well. David's calling in as well. David, appreciate your contributions to our discussion.
Yeah, well, thanks. I was kind of interested in this from the viewpoint, like, if you look at the history of takeovers of nations, you know, whether it happened in Germany, you know, pre-World War II, the currency got devalued so much that everybody that paid obeisance to Hitler and saluted in unison would get daily cost of living. And if you hated Hitler and you would never salute, they would give you monthly or even annual cost of living. And this was at a time where they had the hyperinflation, you know, when you had to have wheelbarrows full of money in order to buy a loaf of bread. So I just expect that Trump is trying to do that again, that if he ruins the American economy badly enough, that we would be able to, or he would be able to get more obeisance from everybody. So Ralph Nader and also Howard Zinn advocated local currencies. And I wonder if you can talk about them in a legal viewpoint. Is there a way that, you know, certain cities or states could come up with local currencies that couldn't be dominated by the whims of corrupt people?
Right. Again, David, appreciating only the perspectives about history, which are important. We often say, of course, that history really doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And I think that's what you're articulating here today. And also this notion that, yes, domestic matters, right, often do influence the conduct of presidents. International matters can also affect their engagement on domestic issues. It goes in both directions, so to speak. And economies, if they do in fact go well, prompt presidents perhaps to be emboldened somewhat. But if they go badly, can also prompt presidents to do things in other areas, including the international scheme, that are not in the best interests. And so we continue to watch, David, consistent with your appropriate concern about the motivations of our president. Maybe they're financial, maybe they're economic, as well as he marches us through these major changes. Without going into great detail, the reality is that when it comes to those issues related to commerce and money and the credit of the United States, all those things are also set forth in the Constitution. They're given to the Congress of the United States. Once again, this is the section that we're talking about a lot this week in Section 8 of Article 1. The Congress has the power to lay and collect taxes and duties and imposts and excises, to pay the debts and collect for the common defense, to borrow money, to regulate commerce, to coin money. And this is the point I'm getting to. This is subsection 5, to regulate the value thereof in a foreign coin and to fix the standard of weights and measures. Now, a huge amount of examination of what that language means has gone on since the time that James Madison wrote it. But the notion is that it's the Congress that coins money and prescribes those kinds of things. Plainly, that has been amplified over the years. We've got the Federal Reserve today that has an awful lot to do with our economic policy. We've got, again, the Bureau of Engraving and Printing that does the very practical things of producing our currency and our coins. We've got the recent proposal, again, lost somewhat in the calamity of recent news by the current president, to get rid of pennies, right? To get rid of CENTS in our national currency. All that kind of thing is under our Constitution to be regulated by our national government, and our Congress in particular. Not to say that local entities and counties, municipalities, towns, villages, and even states don't have roles to play when it comes to our economic vitality. But the coinage itself and the those kinds of commerce things, worth another look to our Constitution as we think beyond that about the role of our president and the Congress going forward. Appreciate very much the call, David, and the perspective that invites even more of our examination of what our founding fathers said and where we are today in America. Appreciate all of our callers again calling in at 855-752-4842. You can also drop text, which Max and I will digest here in Civic Media's studio right here in Racine. I want to spend some time as well talking about Pam Bondi and the Justice Department. We have spent a fair amount of time in previous broadcasts reviewing some of the many things that she has done, to change the ways in which the Department of Justice works. We know that among the many, many things issued by her on her first day in office, and certainly since that time, she has rescinded the Biden policy, again, under the Attorney General tenure of Merrick Garland that prohibited the federal government from going forward to execute any federal prisoners. Doesn't apply to states, but a suspension of federal movement on the execution of federal prisoners facing the death penalty. She has rescinded that and so indicated that it may well be that those remaining prisoners who may be on death row in the future and those who are still there could be executed under this administration. Beyond that, lots of other things. And we know that the Department of Justice continues to make news on a regular basis, breaking as well inside the Department of Justice. Huge issues related to who is working where. We saw the U.S. attorney in Manhattan who resigned not too long ago, along with some of her associates there in the Southern District of New York, some long-standing lawyers in the public integrity section at Main Justice in Washington also resigning over this petition to eliminate, to stop, to dismiss the still living and still out there prosecution of the New York mayor, Eric Adams. That's still pending in front of a federal judge. A lot of people resigned over the motion even being filed by Emile Beauvais, the principal associate deputy attorney general. Resignations going on there. We saw just very recently that in the U.S. attorney's office, the U.S. attorney there, the interim U.S. attorney likely to be confirmed as the permanent or reasonably permanent U.S. attorney there in D.C., has now demoted about seven of the top lawyers who were involved in some of the prosecutions that Donald Trump didn't like, including those against him, including those involving January 6th and other matters that are no longer consistent with Donald Trump's view of what happened in the past and what should happen in the future. All that going on inside of Pam Bondi's Department of Justice, including, of course, her supervision of the new director of the FBI. Yes, indeed, Kash Patel, responsible to the attorney general. As a part of the Department of Justice, that is how things work. That's the structure of the department. In connection with the structure of the department, again, Pam Bondi issuing lots and lots of policies. Not too long ago, she issued a new memorandum on sentencing and charging decisions. And as I said at the top of the show, this is very important because it changes the ways in which assistant U.S. attorneys in offices around the nation, and yes, indeed, attorneys at Main Justice in Washington, D.C., look at cases, charge cases. At what standard should they make those decisions? It is another change. It's a departure from the bipartisan consensus about the past, and including some failures on the war on drugs and mandatory minimum sentences. Now Pam Bondi is ordering that all prosecutors, in the absence of what she says are unusual facts, to charge and pursue what are called the most serious, readily provable offenses. Now, that language is very important. It has surfaced under other administrations as well. And why is it important? Because it is a change in this regard. In previous administrations, including the one for which I worked under Eric Holder, Barack Obama, including the past administration under Joe Biden and Attorney General Merrick Garland, a 2022 memorandum reaffirmed a fundamental notion that said directed that prosecutors have discretion and they should pursue only those charges that result in the advancement of justice, in mandatory minimum sentences after an individualized assessment of, here we go, the circumstances surrounding them. In other words, judges are presented with positions of the Department of Justice that are premised upon an assessment of the particular defendant and of the circumstances, and yes, indeed, have choices to make about which offenses to charge, which ones not to charge, with the ultimate goal of doing what? Accomplishing justice, in particular cases on behalf of you and me, to ensure that the community is safe and secure, but doing that in a way that gives prosecutors, U.S. attorneys, assistant U.S. attorneys, people populating these various litigating offices at Main Justice, the capacity to make those individualized judgments that are important to the rule of law. The sentences of the past that have been premised upon the serious, most readily provable offenses that do not take into account the particular circumstances, an awful lot of people look at those and they say they've often caused unwarranted disproportions in sentences and severe sentences that are not consistent with the rule of law. Pam Bondi changing that past now to regard the prosecution of cases only when they're pursued under serious, readily provable offenses. More of that and more coming up here on Amicus, a Law Review.
This is News from the Center, WRCE. Nightlight with Pete Schwalbe.
I'm very excited. It is my pleasure to welcome tonight my old pal, Dr. Kristen Lierley. I told the entire listening audience that I rub my feet together sometime when I watch TV, and I called it self-cuddling. And it's like the only thing we do where we rub our own bodies when we relax, you know.
Is it? Are you telling that to a gynecologist? Pete, come on.
Nightlight with Pete Schwalbe. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Dom Salvia Show.
You know, Harvey, the seemingly purposeful no action. What's your sense on the leadership in the Dem Party right now, Harvey?
I'm ashamed of them. What did Trump have on all these people?
Yeah, right.
That we get this kind of silence. Will the Democratic leadership figure out that it's their task to start articulating a Democratic, small d, Democratic vision and project that these people can rally behind? Bam.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app. You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, and this is the last segment of our broadcast on this weekend. Value so very much the contributions that so many people have made to our broadcast this weekend, including very recently Chuck, who's dropped a note or two into our chat line, noting that piggybacking on Joe's very good comment about the maps of Europe and Ukraine. And noting, Chuck does, that until Vance interrupted, Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, was beginning to explain that though separated by oceans, the U.S. feels the war's impact nonetheless. Exactly. Also, Chuck notes that Ukraine is the breadbasket of the world and unable to farm and export its grains. That was one of the primary reasons for global inflation and food prices blowing up. Again, echoing some of the comments from Rick and Joe. Chuck, appreciate very much that perspective as well. In our final moments and our minutes here on Amicus, a Law Review, staying there in Washington, D.C., moving, marching right down Pennsylvania Avenue from the White House to the Department of Justice, back to the Hill, where the Supreme Court, of course, is located. A couple of significant things going on from the pens and the actions of our Supreme Court just this past week. Again, much of that eclipsed by the news coming out of the Department of Justice and the White House. Supreme Court continues to entertain oral arguments, and we spent a lot of time on this broadcast telling you more about those, the significance of those, all of that, of course, anticipating that sometime probably in May and into June, they'll begin to issue their decisions on these major issues. Just this past week on Monday, for example, a major oral argument having to do with the future of Ruben Gutierrez, who is right now one of those federal defendants on death row, Gutierrez versus Sayens, a case concerning the execution, the planned execution of Gutierrez. He was involved in a capital murder and sentenced to death for his involvement in a robbery and a killing back in 1998. The Supreme Court entertaining oral argument on that very important case, not just for that particular defendant, but for all of us who are focusing upon the death penalty in America these days. On Tuesday, Supreme Court had additional arguments in a case called Asteris versus United States. It concerns the factors that courts, federal courts, should use when deciding whether to revoke an individual's supervised release term. People are our post-prison, post-incarceration. What are the factors that courts should use and invoke in determining whether or not their freedom from prison should be terminated and they should be sent back to prison for various pieces of conduct? What are the factors that should be used? That was on Tuesday. Also, they undertook a case called Purtue versus Richards. Had to do with another criminal matter. Cases subject to something called the Prison Litigation Reform Act, sometimes called the PLRA. Do prisoners have a right to a jury concerning the exhaustion of their administrative remedies when there are disputed facts about that exhaustion? A lot of legal stuff going on there, but also an issue important to our federal prisoners. That was, again, on Tuesday. And finally, on Wednesday, a case very important to employment discrimination, arguably touching upon a lot of the jobs-related issues that we've seen coming out of the White House recently. A significant case involving Ames, Ames versus Ohio Department of Youth Services, an employment discrimination claim for minority groups. And this one does deserve a bit more exposition. Ames involves a rule that exists in some federal appeals courts that requires employment discrimination plaintiffs, the people who are bringing the cases forward, who are in a majority, for example, a racial minority or other majorities, immutable characteristics, if they're in a majority category, to carry a higher burden, a higher evidentiary burden than plaintiffs who are in a minority group. And this particular case involves a straight woman who was denied a promotion and then later demoted. And in both cases, the position she wanted was filled by a gay employee. Now, in most federal courts, plaintiffs who are in the position of the majority are treated no differently from plaintiffs who are in a minority position. And that's consistent with a case, a lot of legal history here, in a case called McDonald versus Santa Fe Trail Transport way back in 1976 that basically said that federal law prohibits racial discrimination against white people on the same standards as would be applicable if they were black. Everybody's got a fair and even playing field when it comes to Title VII lawsuits alleging employment discrimination. Again, in this case, the Supreme Court not resolving the merits of this particular case brought by Ames, but reestablishing this common fighting ground, if you will, the basis upon which an Ames-type plaintiff can, in fact, prosecute her case. Pretty much no one, including the Solicitor General, suggested that this background circumstances rule that was coming out of one of our circuit courts in particular should remain. And indeed, it's one of those situations where, as Neil Gorsuch said, everybody's in radical agreement, which we don't see all the time coming out of the Supreme Court. Everybody in the courtroom, all the people arguing or orally, all the Supreme Court justices seem to agree that there's not much doubt about how this case should turn out, nor realistically should there be. And again, I hope that all of you digesting some of this should say, yeah, everybody should be on the same plane when it comes to arguing whatever their employment discrimination claim should be. Federal law and the decisions under McDonald, those cases that are guiding all of this, are clear that employment discrimination cases brought by majority plaintiffs should proceed on the same terms as any other employment discrimination case. And what that does, of course, is it means that when they finally decide, when they finally issue this opinion in the Ames case, likely will be somewhat uneventful. Indeed, we've got Justice Brett Kavanaugh who floated the idea of a very short opinion fairly soon, simply stating that the rules are the same regardless of whether a particular plaintiff is in the majority or minority. And again, Neil Gorsuch, who is often one of the justices most eager to remake some of this kind of law, seemed to endorse that proposal, anticipating that, and again, Ames will reestablish an important concept for everyone going forward when they allege employment discrimination in this case called Ames versus Ohio Department of Youth Services. That happened just this past week. The other important thing in our last minute here is the Supreme Court stayed an important decision coming out of a district court, issuing an interim order placing on hold a Washington-based decision that imposed a deadline when it came to coming to this foreign aid that the president had suspended. The Supreme Court saying, we'll take a look at this, and while we're doing that, the decision of the lower court telling Donald Trump that he cannot do what he wanted to do when it comes to foreign aid and USAID. Supreme Court saying now, we'll stop that from going ahead. We're going to take a look at that, presumably fairly quickly, and get back to you. We're going to get back to you again next weekend here on Amicus Law Review as we continue to address these issues of law and government and rule of law in our nation and across.
News from the Center, WRCE.
Ingram.
It's Motown Monday on the Earl Ingram Show, and I have a fantastic guest ready to chat about the latest developments in both local and national news. Be sure to tune in and find out.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 till 10.
At National Geographic Society, we believe in the power of wonder. It drives us to explore, pushes us to see the world differently, moves us to action. And we believe that today, wonder is more essential than ever.
Wow.
That's why we're supporting a new generation of explorers to ask big questions, make breakthroughs, and bring the future closer. Wonder awaits. Will you join us? Visit natgeo.org/wonder.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packard. Elon Musk doubling down on his Doge drive to slash federal spending with a new round of emails to federal workers demanding they list five tasks they completed at work last week by Monday night. Musk saying those who fail to respond will be fired. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth giving guidance for civilian employees at the Pentagon.
I am now directing each member of the department's civilian workforce, just civilian, to provide those five bullets on what they accomplished in their specific jobs last week, to reply to that email and CC their immediate supervisors. It's a simple task.
Damage control for Ukraine after President Zelensky left Washington without a deal after a heated meeting with President Trump in the Oval Office. Zelensky and other European leaders met in London today, where it was announced that the UK and France would work on Ukraine peace plan, which would then be discussed with the U.S. Some buildings damaged, none destroyed, as a 1,200-acre wildfire burns in South Carolina. This is ABC News.